this is another hymn like the Billings Independence. But folks, it makes even more explicit than does Independence the fact that the God that the American Republic identified with was not Jesus, but God the who? God the Father, Jehovah God. And here, that God is even called Jehovah. Will you listen with me to this hymn? Follow the text. The text is self-explanatory. Child of heaven. Can you hear echoes of Billings in it? He's already began to have an effect on American writers. Peace is going to revive the country. Swords in the plowshares.
Shall laugh and sing,
shall laugh and sing,
and freedom spread the voice of gladness round. Shall laugh and sing, and freedom spread the voice of gladness round. Oh, sing a jubilant song to God, your hymn.
God rules the heart of mighty kings. And gave our arms success. God draws the line. Confess Jehovah's power. Explicitly.
His wondrous works proclaim. His wondrous works.
All righty. The providential nature of the American Republic. Yes, ma'am. Jehovah is the name. What does the name Jehovah mean? What is it? Yes. There isn't really a name. There's not a meaning. It's what the letters of God, of Jehovah's name, means in Hebrew. All righty. But if you call God, God, one of the ways you can call him is Jehovah. Folks, the only point here is it's not Jesus. The founders hardly ever talk about Jesus. But they talk a lot about God. A God who is in a covenanted, providential relationship with the American Republic. Uniquely so. All righty. But guess what? Some of them did talk about Jesus. And one of them talked about Jesus a lot. And you know which one I'm talking about. So let's talk about Tom Jefferson for just a minute. Now, the reason that Dr. Miller's not going to lecture a lot about Jefferson should be obvious. Why am I not going to lecture a lot about Jefferson? Because you got buku people throwing things at you about Jefferson. All righty? But I want to say a few things, two or three. First of all, I need to emphasize the extent to which the third president of the United States was a long, lifelong, hostile critic of organized religion and religious professionals, clerics, priests. He believed that organized religion and the priests of organized religion throughout history had worked ill in the world through their intolerance, and you know all of that. One of Thomas Jefferson's three proudest accomplishments, he said, and that one of the three things he wanted on his tombstone is that in 1786, he authored the Virginia Declaration of Religious Freedom that said that, in Virginia at least, there will be no connection between a man's civic personality and his religious beliefs. No connection at all. And Jefferson's Great Declaration then serves as a model for the First Amendment to the Federal Constitution. Thomas Jefferson also welcomed the disestablishment of the churches, especially the Church of England. And he welcomed the world of religious denominational competition that followed the end of the establishment. He welcomed this competition because he believed out of all of this competition of various religious beliefs would finally emerge, guess what? True religion. Let's call it natural religion. We will call it true religion. Get in there and fight it out. And all the bad religious ideas are going to do what? They're going to die away. How naive. Guess what he thought would survive? Unitarianism. He said, everyone, at one day there will be a time when every young man is a cordial Unitarian. No belief in religious superstition like Jesus' divinity, but religion that he called, thank you, Jacob, natural, Jason, natural religion. And you've read about that. Now, it's not correct to say that for Thomas Jefferson, natural religion would be rational and reasonable. We say that too much. That's what we say enlightened religion is. Well, there's a sense in which that is true. But there's something beyond just being rational and reasonable. Jefferson also believed that true religion finally would resonate with the way things are. True religion would resonate with the way things are. It would resonate with the natural order of things. It would simply fall into place And it would be self-evident because of that. Natural religion is not just rational and reasonable. It falls into place of its own accord with the natural order. The next thing I'd like to say about Jefferson is about the process by which he thought about Jesus and formulated his thoughts. I would like to point out the level at which this conversation took place. This conversation about the nature of Jesus and his role in the world and religion took place at the very highest levels of American society. And the cut-and-paste job occurred, at least in part, in the White House. He corresponds with some of the most important people in the United States. His vice president, John Adams, right? Can you name another? Was it? Benjamin Rush, Joseph Priestley. Started with a P, you're pretty good, Joseph. Great scientists, great thinkers. Folks, this is not a tiny, inconsequential part of the American elite. It's at the very highest level. And I also want to point out, Jefferson, with respect to the quest for the historical Jesus. When Dr. White talks about Jefferson, about the quest for the historical Jesus, he makes Thomas Jefferson part of it. In fact, he kind of says that in the United States, it sort of starts with Jesus. I think that Dr. White is essentially wrong about that. I don't think Dr. White is wrong about many things. But I think he's essentially wrong about this. He is right to point out that Jefferson's writing occurs simultaneously with the beginnings of the modern quest for the historical Jesus. Especially in Germany, thinkers in the first decades of the 19th century were carrying on researches into which Jesus was to be put into his own culture. You study the languages of his culture, Aramaic, Hebrew, Greek. You study archaeology. What else do you study? Literature, memoirs, anything you can get your hand on. The end is to put Jesus in his historical context. Folks, I don't think Thomas Jefferson cared a whit about that. He had no interest in the historical Jesus at all. And he really didn't have any use for the Christ of faith. Well, who was his Jesus then? Thomas Jefferson extracts Jesus, bless you. Thomas Jefferson, in fact, extracts Jesus from his culture. Does he, in his little excerpts, does he try to tell you about what they wore in the first century? Or what a synagogue looked like? Or how many different kinds of dyes there were? No. He's not interested in that at all. He instead looks to Jesus for the same thing he looks to Socrates for. What does he look to both of these people for, both him and Franklin? Moral and ethical modeling. Now, something that's not in your book and that you need to be responsible for is why? It's just too easy to say, well, everyone was looking to Jesus for a moral, ethical model. Why? Why did Ben Franklin look to Jesus as a moral and ethical model? I told you we were going to have discussion. It is now time for you to discuss. Yes, sir. Because it was something that people already knew about. What do you mean by that? Okay, it had universal currency. I hadn't thought about that, but it made sense. It made social, utilitarian sense, didn't it? Yes, ma'am. is he talking about becoming saved? Not saved. Can I get a witness? Not saved. Salvation has nothing to do with this. Why? Why does he not worry about it? I told you last time. Frank? Can't know and just wait a few minutes, all righty? Right. God is sovereign. That's for God to figure out. Folks, that's just exactly what John Carvin said. Exactly. Do you understand that? That's Ben Franklin, John said exactly the same thing. Can't know. But John Calvin worried about it a lot. Jefferson didn't. Partly because Jefferson had this enormous ego. Any guy with any right mind was going to say, good show, Ben, and put him up front, right? You realize that, don't you? He wasn't sweating it at all. I mean, at all. All right. So why is Franklin interested in people being moral and ethical? Why does he give money to all those churches? No, Franklin. We haven't quite finished. Roger? It's good for people to be moral. Why, Roger? Because it keeps them in line. Folks, that's a little cynical and a little 21st century, but it will do in a pinch. Keep them in line. It will keep people in moral place, in social places. Folks, it has a utilitarian value. Now, is that what Thomas Jefferson is going to use moral and ethical for? Because it's socially utilitarian? Folks, what does utilitarian mean? Useful. Thank you very much. Yes. No. Well, why? Why? Why does he think it's good to contemplate Jesus as a moral and ethical model? It's good. That's actually right, Jason. It's good to live a good life for the sake of the individual. It makes you a better person in and of yourself, as opposed to making you obedient to your masters or whatever. It is the way in which a man becomes virtuous. Bless you. Virtuous. And this is what's not in your text. Virtuous. What did the 18th century mean by virtuous? What do we mean by virtuous? Oh, she's the most virtuous person I've ever met. What does that mean? Does a person in our politics campaign by saying, vote for me, I'm the most virtuous candidate, particularly if your name is Mark Foley? Do we even talk about virtue? Do we even use the word anymore? Do you know what the hell I'm talking about? No, because we don't use it anymore. But in the world we have lost, the little r Republican world of Thomas Jefferson, little v virtue was the most important word. What did it mean, young people? Someone tell me. Roger? And what were some of those morals or good things? Well, not actually for Republican Greece and Rome. What were that were the model? Yes, Miss 18th century student. and Stephanie, tell these people what kinds of things that the citizen had to be, putting her on a spot now. What did you have as to be a good Republican? The little R. And how? Yes, you vote for, you don't, when you vote, you're not swayed by other people. You look out for what? Your own interest? No, what? What did you say? You said it. The good of society. Because society has a good in common. And it's called the common good. The virtuous person is that person who doesn't look out for self-interest, but the interest of other people. You can rise above your own interest. By the way, they use a word here properly. This is a good 18th century word. They're supposed to be disinterested. Not uninterested, but disinterested. Disinterested in the 18th century means rising above the interests around you. Not that you're not uninterested in interests, you're above them. You are disinterested, selfless, honest, independent, not ruled by passions. The American people embarked in 1786 on a Republican government, little r. What does Republican government with a little r mean? At its basis is what? What kind of government is it? Starts with an R also. Someone said it. Thank you, Mary. Representative government. You're not ruled by a king or a queen and their sway with their army. That's monarchy. Boo hiss. We just rebelled again. Nor are we Democrats with a little d. What does Democrat mean? With a little d. Democratic. What does it mean? Who rules in a democracy?
The mob.
Everybody. Well, it doesn't have to be the mob, but it usually is. Okay? Let's all vote, go down the square, and everyone vote, right? Well, we can't do that. We're too many of us. So you have to have a representative government. People rule themselves through representative government, okay? But in order to do that, their leaders, first of all, you have to be yourself virtuous. So you can be trusted to vote for the best people and not your own selfish interest. And then your leaders have to be able to rise above their own interest and the interest of the people who elected them and to vote for the common good. Young people, how spectacularly does that sound in our own day? But that's what kind of government we have, folks, for good or for ill. And it's the great tragedy of American society. Anyhow. That's why Thomas Jefferson wants you to look at Jesus. Jesus teaches us how to be virtuous. By the way, you could also look to Jesus as a model for ethical and moral behavior for another social end. And we will get to that in the first next part of the course. Can anyone sort of guess ahead of me? Look ahead of me? What you might want to do to society after you have become socially aware and moral and ethical? Improve it. Change it. Reform it. Having reformed yourself, you're going to reform society. Check me next week. All righty? But that's not what Jefferson is talking about now. He is interested in Jesus as a model of Republican virtue. Now, none of you thought of that. And if I ask you to write about Jefferson on your paper, I don't want just that. I want you to tell me now, why, from your reading of that Bible, who is Thomas Jefferson's Jesus? Yes, ma'am. Jefferson's Jesus certainly is his own idiosyncratic Jesus. Can we all get a witness? I mean, cut, paste, right? But having said that, What are some of the things we find in this Jesus? We know what, do you know who Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John's Jesus is? Well, who's the gospel according to St. Tom? Jenna? Moral. Why no miracles? Supernatural. Why is that bad? Okay. Tell me. Denies the laws of nature. It asks you to believe something that rational people can't believe. And you don't want to try kind of trust people who are believing things that are not reasonable. Yes, ma'am. Benevolent. Looking out for other people. What does he mean by sublime? Anyone else catch that word? Because in fact, he does talk about Jesus as sublime. Okay, good. Good here. He surpasses all humans in excellency. And Aaron's emphasis is on human. So what does the word sublime mean? Is sublime a working part of your vocabulary, young people? Was it? Actually, it is supposed to be up there somewhere, isn't it? Somewhere above us, something that takes us out of ourselves. We usually think about terms, sublimity in terms of what part of creation? You ever been to the Grand Canyon? You ever been to Grand Canyon? How have you been to Grand Canyon? Okay. What'd you think? Oh, that's so sublime. Our Niagara Falls? That's what the 19th century, sublime. Takes it you out of yourself. Nature grabs you and takes you somewhere else. And it may not be quite heaven, but it's not here either. And you're a better person for it. Got it? All righty? Yes, so what else can we say about Jesus, Jefferson's Jesus? Jeff's Jesus. Knowable Jesus. The word is intelligible, okay? No mystery here. No mystery here because we got to get all the word out to everybody, right? Roger, you have something else to add? Okay. Yes. Thank you very much. Have you noticed how many times this Jesus is rebelling against the establishment? Now, does Jefferson add anything to the biblical record? No, it's all there. But if you take out all this other stuff, guess what happens to the stuff that's left? Did you say it pops out? I liked hops out. It does. Thank you, buddy. It does. It just hops out. And all of a sudden, who knew? It was there. All righty. What else? Good. We're on a roll.
Folks, I can see you in the back. We need you to talk to me.
What else? Yes, ma'am. Notice this? Isn't that wonderful? He's Socratic. By the way, Jesus is Socratic. So Jesus is always there. So what do you think? Who told you that? Ask me something. He is Socratic. Yes. Sage. What's a sage, John? Easy. Dr. Miller is a sage, right? Wise man, yes. Can I get with you? Yes. Enlightened. Mr. Know-it-all. Jesus knows everything. All righty, what else? Yes. How do you mean? That's interesting. Roger says his life is open. Okay. He does, in fact. He tells you how to do it, and then he models it. Lord's Prayer, he'd even do it yourself. He'll do it himself. Okay, good. What else? All righty. Now, let's bracket the gospel according to Tom. Go back 30 years.
Return with me now.
Actually, more than that. Go back to the last century. To Jonathan Edwards. and his personal narrative. What is this document? What is the personal narrative of Jonathan Edwards? Folks do not come to this test without having conquered this document. Can I get a witness? Look at me. Thank you. So, what is this document? First of all, it's an autobiography. And what is it biograph? What does it tell you about? Feelings, boku feelings. Thank you very much. What else? Transformation. This is the story of his conversion experience. Come on. Play with me. His conversion experience. Folks, it's one of the most beautiful testimonies of an evangelical conversion experience ever written. Folks, pay attention to this document. This is a beautiful, beautiful document written by one of the most intelligent people humanity ever produced. Period. Jonathan Edwards. Now, who's his Jesus? What one word would you use to describe Jonathan Edwards' Jesus? Sweet. Now, young people, I ask you, what the hell does it mean to God? Sweet Jesus. My grandma said that was not a good thing. He said, sweet, sweet. Folks, do you think John Calvin ever said, oh, sweet Jesus? Probably not. What does it mean, sweet? I mean, that is such a debased word in our culture, isn't it? But what does it mean to Jonathan Edwards? What is it? Good to the soul, buddy, and good for the soul. Just give that soul all the sweetness you can find. What else? What does sweetness mean? Loving, okay, that's good. And when Jesus is being sweet with him, what's he doing? What's happening to Jonathan Edwards? What's the result of all this sweetness from Jesus? Salvation. Conversion. Now, what does Jonathan Edwards' sweet Jesus enable him to finally accept? The sovereignty of God.
I woke up this morning with my mind.
Standing
on Jesus, I woke up this morning with my mind. Standing on Jesus, I woke up this morning with my mind. Standing on Jesus, hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. I'm walking and talking with my mind.